Good day. Thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Ballast Asset Management third quarter investor call. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Mr. Brian Smith. You may go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone, to the Ballast call. My name is Brian Smith, CEO of SkyPoint Capital. Before we get started, just wanted to read a few performance metrics from the third quarter. The Ballast portfolio returned 0.6% net of fees compared to negative 2.1% for the Russell 2500. Over the last 12 months, from September 30th, 2020 to September 30th, 2021, the Ballast portfolio returned 71% net of fees compared to 54.3% for the Russell 2500 value. Over a five-year period from September 30th, 2016 to September 30th, 2021, the Ballast portfolio has returned 16.16% annualized net of fees compared to 10.5% annualized for the Russell 2500 value. Our call theme today is your equity portfolio positioned for inflation? And our speaker is founder of Ballast Asset Management, Reagan Stanky. Reagan has over 20 years experience in the financial services industry, spanning from early stage investing in startups to public equities. Before founding Ballast Asset Management, Reagan was with Westwood from 2004 to 2015 and was responsible for managing and growing the SMID product from its infancy to over $3 billion. Upon closing the SMID Value product, Reagan launched a sister portfolio in SMID Value Plus, where he raised nearly $1 billion in assets. During his management of the SMID Value portfolio, had a 10-year track record that ranked in the top 10% against its respective peer group. Reagan was also a member of the Portfolio Risk Committee and Business Management Committee at Westwood. Reagan has served in previous roles with Arthur Andersen and the Business Valuation Group and at UBS as a research analyst focused on the software industry. With that, Reagan, I'm going to hand the call over to you.
Thanks, Brian. I just want to start off today by reiterating that I've managed this strategy for over 18 years and previously ran $4.5 billion in mostly institutional money at Westwood before starting Ballast. And previous to that, I was an analyst, and I give you all of that just because I want to point out something that I think is very important, which is that I haven't seen this level of disparity between large cap growth and small cap value since the dot-com bubble. And just to give you a couple of numbers, back in the 99-2000 timeframe, the Russell large cap growth index traded at 34 times earnings, or roughly 34 before it spent a month or so in the early part of 2000 and spiking above that, which is right where we are today. And small cap value today trades at 14 times earnings, which is actually a couple of turns less than where it was back in 99. The Ballast mid cap portfolio is 11 times earnings. Again, when you look at both the absolute number and the large cap relative to small cap, that the multiple, we're at historic highs. And just to give you a little perspective on what things look like after that, you know, if you look at a longer term perspective, when you've had these types of dispersions, small cap has outperformed by an average of almost 17% over the next decade after we've seen that. And coming out of the dot-com bubble bursting, the period of from the end of 99 through the end of 2006, we saw the Russell 1000 growth index fall 30%, while Russell 2000 value index climbed 185%. And the vast majority of that negative return on the Russell 1000 growth was because that multiple that I spoke to earlier fell by over 50% over that period of time, while the small cap value enjoyed continued compounding of earnings growth on pretty similar PE ratios. And so one other thing that was really interesting about that period of time and now is the level of concentration of some of the biggest companies within these indices. Specifically, as I think about the S&P 500, the top six companies make up 25% of the S&P. And those are Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Tesla, Facebook, and Google. Again, historically, when you get that level of concentration in an index, it hasn't turned out real well over the future. And so I bring all of this up because I'm often asked if the small cap move that we saw late 2020 and into 2021, if it's over. Again, my perspective and just looking back at history, I think this has a long way to play out. And whether you're concerned about the risk, which I think is in large cap growth, or the opportunity, which I believe is in small cap value, I think this is set up quite nicely for that transition. Now, moving on from that, I wanted to focus on inflation on the call today, and this has obviously been something that has been much talked about within both analyst write-ups and in the media. Most of the commentary heretofore has been around what the Fed calls transitory inflation, and Chairman Powell spoke to this again yesterday. And when they're talking about transitory inflation and the idea that that will revert back to a mean or calm down within the next year or so, largely what they're speaking to is inflation that's caused by supply chain issues, labor shortages, and commodity prices. And I wouldn't actually disagree that all of those things likely take care of themselves in the short to medium term, i.e. the next, call it 12 to 18 months. The shutdown from COVID caused material disruption in both production and liquidation of inventory. All of those things are, we witnessed a lot of this back in the 06, 07 business cycle when you had port congestion, et cetera, et cetera. And those things tend to work their way through the system over time. The part that I don't believe is being focused on is the desire that was really took off coming out of COVID for a transition to a carbon zero economy, and the realities that that bring to play. So first and foremost, what it has caused is a dramatic shift to ESG investing. I've seen numbers that there's currently roughly $38 trillion in ESG funds at the moment that is moving up to, expected to move up to $53 trillion by 2025. And specifically as that relates to two things. One, the effect that it has on what I'll call traditional energy, so think fossil fuels, and the reality that those funds and are not investing in traditional fossil fuels. And so that's taking up the cost of equity for traditional E&Ps. We've also seen a big shift within a lot of the large banks not wanting to lend to these traditional E&Ps. And so you likely see the cost of debt go up. And so the point is that both a combination of a cost of capital going up and what is a more recent requirement of E&Ps to actually generate free cash flow as opposed to pure production or earnings growth, all of those things are stymieing production growth and making traditional E&Ps much more focused on returns and less focused on production. And that is, in our opinion, likely to keep the cost of oil and gas at elevated levels. At the same time, there's a huge cost to building out the renewable infrastructure. And the numbers are all over the place at the moment, but some of the numbers that I've read that if we were to, about 80% of electricity in the United States comes from fossil fuel. So if we were to transition completely from fossil fuel energy production to 100% renewable energy production over the next decade, numbers I've seen, it would cost roughly $6 trillion. And, just thinking about where that money comes from within the current proposal, Biden's proposal to go through reconciliation, they're targeting something around $550 billion in total for clean energy. And that would include things like energy charging stations or electricity charging stations, et cetera, et cetera. And so, that's a huge amount of capital that investors are going to require some rate of return on in order to spend the money on that build out. And another interesting article that I read shows that the when you think of storage, battery storage for electricity that comes from either solar or wind, et cetera, the cost per kilowatt hour of electricity from a battery is estimated to be right about $250 per kilowatt hour. And that compares to natural gas at about $50. And so about a fivefold increase in the cost of that electricity. And so you've got two things going on. Number one, the capital required and the rate of return that is going to be sought on that capital to build out the renewable infrastructure. And two, the current cost all in of that renewable energy. Now, over time, technology is going to catch up, and there will definitely be deflationary impacts on that over the long term. But in our opinion, in the medium term, over the next decade or so, all of these costs combined with the stymied production on fossil fuels is going to lead to higher energy costs again for at least the next 10 years or so. And so even if the supply chain inflation is ultimately sorted out within the next year or so, we believe that we're going to be facing higher energy costs for the foreseeable future, and that is likely to not be transitory in nature. And so the question is that if we're right, and if inflation is here to stay at levels that we haven't seen over the last 30 or 40 years, how do you protect yourself? And what we're focused on is two things: owning businesses with real assets, and so that's a combination of both real estate and commodities, who will see the value of those real assets appreciate with inflation. And to the extent that they have any debt, that debt obviously depreciates as inflation rises. And the second is really focused on companies with pricing power such that they can protect themselves against that inflation, i.e. that they're able to pass through higher prices onto their customers. And so that can be a combination of companies where the product is needed, where they have a dominant market share position, and where there are little, if any, substitutes for that product. And so the third thing is, or the fourth thing I should say, is that where you see a low cost of goods sold, so high gross margins in businesses. And so think of the example of a software company like Microsoft, for instance, that has where you have to pay annual subscriptions or even monthly subscriptions for their product, and they can and there's, I would argue, very little substitution for most of Microsoft's products on our desktop. And so they can push through those price increases quite easily, and their fixed costs associated with that are quite low. And I would contrast that to a grocery store or an airline or a cruise ship. And there's a number of examples where they have low margins anyway. There's an easy cost of substitution, there's a low cost of substitution, and in many cases they're not required. And so those types of businesses are likely to struggle the most in an inflationary environment. And we think that that will be critically important as investors to focus on as we go through this period of time. And I want to wrap up by just giving a quick recap of our third quarter performance and highlighting some of the businesses that did best and businesses that did not as well during the quarter. And so our top performers were Goodrich Petroleum, which is a natural gas producer in the Haynesville, was up 58% in the quarter and is up over 100% for the year. Teradata, which is a technology company that we've owned for a number of years, was up 15% in the quarter and is up over 150% for the year. On Semiconductor was up 20% in the quarter and is up almost 80% on the year. On is we've heard a lot about the semiconductor shortages globally on is certainly benefiting from that, but more importantly, they are a critical component on new cars and all of the sensors that are going into new cars, and we think that there is a very long runway for them. In terms of our bottom performers, Avid is a technology company that supplies software to the production and entertainment industry. It was off 26%, and Texas Pacific Land Trust was off 24% in the quarter. It's a royalty oil play out in the Permian. I think it's important to note that we actually cut those both of those position sizes in half prior to this quarter, and those were up still up year to date, 90% and 70% respectively. So been tremendous performers for us. Just took a bit of breather in the third quarter, and then America's Car Mart was off 18%. Again, still up 12% for the year. But there was concern there around it's a, they sell used cars and just about the price of used cars and whether they would be able to pass that along in terms of their margins, which we believe they will and historically have. In terms of our expectations going forward, I would just reiterate that we believe strongly that small cap value is will likely outperform, especially large cap growth over the next several years. Very excited about the businesses that we own and the upside potential, which we believe is over 100% on the current portfolio, and think that we are well positioned to protect our investors and customers in a rising rate and higher inflationary environment. And with that, I just want to turn the call back over to Brian for any questions.
Great. Thank you, Reagan. Operator, we can open up the phone lines for questions, please. Reagan, while we're waiting, real quick, can you just talk about the Fed's comments yesterday on tapering and what, you know, higher rate environment, how it will benefit, you know, the companies in the portfolio that how you're focused on free cash flow and how it will be problematic for companies that rely on borrowing for their growth?
Sure. So there's a lot in that question. So first and foremost, the Fed Chairman Powell did confirm that they're likely to begin tapering. And so I want to make a quick distinction just between tapering and rising rates, right? So tapering would be buying the Fed actually buying less fixed income, whether it's mortgages or treasuries, starting next year. And then the other question is that the Chairman Powell was asked a lot about was when they would start to actually raise rates, and that appears to be off the table until sometime next year at the moment. However, in a by definition, if you have less demand for that those bonds, we should see rates start to tick up. Just as they begin to taper, even without raising rates, unless we get incremental demand from somewhere else. We believe that ultimately, if we're right, that inflation is not as transitory as the Fed believes, that they will be forced to begin raising rates in order to combat that. And within that rising rate environment, you've got several things going on. A, you've got businesses that actually benefit from that, and a steepening in the yield curve, such as financials. B, you have businesses that that turns into a headwind from. So anybody that can't self-finance their business, whether looking to raise money to finance their business, that turns into a headwind for those guys. And C, going back to the very first comment that I made on valuation, by definition, again, just as you think of your standard discounted cash flow model, as rates go up, that means that your cost of capital goes up, which means future earnings are worth less, right? And so for those companies, and I'm specifically talking about growth companies here, who are being valued on the prospects years and years from now, the value of those businesses and those cash flow streams go down as rates go up, whereas the value of companies that are generating free cash flow today aren't nearly as affected by that and should be favored over those growth companies.
Great, thank you. Operator, are there any questions?
We have a question from David Boho.
Okay, excellent.
Your line is open.
Hey, Regan, thanks for the call, and nice job navigating this market. I was just curious if you could give a feel of, you know, portfolio turnover, you know, in the quarter and the year, if that's, you know, higher or lower, if that's been about the same, and just, you know, remind me again where that is. Thank you.
You bet. Yeah, our portfolio turnover this year is about 20%. I don't know what that number is specifically for the quarter, but that tells you where it is for the year. And that's in line with, again, over the last 18 years or so, our turnover tends to be about 20 to 30%. And, you know, it kind of lines up with our view. We take a three-year view on businesses when we buy them. Turnover is somewhat lower right now because of all of the changes that we made in, especially in the first quarter and early part of the second quarter of 2020, taking advantage of what was some pretty severe price dislocation as a result of COVID.
Reagan, as a follow-up to that question, you said you trimmed back the two positions. Were there new additions in the quarter, or were those simply just reallocated to existing positions?
Those were reallocated to existing positions. We had a couple of new positions that we initiated in the first and second quarter of this year, and we took the opportunity to add to some of those positions, along with a couple of others that we took up in August when the market pulled back.
Okay. Well, Reagan, thank you very much for the information today. Very informative as always. We look for continued success with the strategy, and also want to thank everyone for joining the call. There will be a replay made available that will be out probably in the next 5 to 7 days, and we look forward to talking to everybody again next quarter. Thank you.